Hello, welcome to Mind Chat. My name's Philip Goff.
Hello, welcome to Mind Chat. My name's Keith Frankish.
Hello, Keith, how are you doing? I know you've been saddened this week by the death of your good friend Daniel Dennett. How have you?
Indeed. Yes, it was a big blow. He was he'd been an intellectual hero of mine for decades, and in recent years, personal friend, fairly close personal friend, and it was a big shock. He was my compass, I suppose, philosophical compass, and I think, I mean, it's a huge loss for philosophy generally. It's a loss for me and the others, who, other people, friends and family, of course, personally. But it's a huge loss for philosophy generally. I think everyone would agree that he was a giant in the field, and that whether you agreed with him or disagreed with him, I think everyone took him seriously and knew that he was that his work was essential reading in the field. So yes, it's a big loss, I think, for everyone in this, who's interested in understanding the mind.
Absolutely. Well, I didn't know Dennett as well as you did, Keith, at all, but I did have the pleasure of spending the week on the boat in the Arctic with him, with you, as the mm-hmm. time we met 10 years ago, and he was kind to me. And also, yeah, had the honour last year of doing a little bit of philosophical sparring on BBC Radio 3, talking about our new books on the... obviously I disagree with Dennett about almost everything, as I do with you, Keith, but he was a truly great philosopher. And it's hard to think of someone, actually, I was just thinking, who's had a bigger influence on both academic and in the popular sphere. I mean, each individually, but also together in recent times. So yeah, a really, really big
figure. And I think his influence will continue both through his own work, which will go into the pantheon of classic philosophy, but also through all the many, many people he's influenced, the many students that he's taught, the people he's mentored, and simply through people who have read his work and been influenced by it. I think he's going to continue to shape the discipline of philosophy of mind for generations. And that's, I think, the positive way to look at his loss, that the things he really cared about will continue to be the causes he cared about. People will continue to advocate. There's a lot more to be said, and maybe we'll.
We should put in the show notes. You wrote a wonderful piece, popular article for IAEI, Institute of Arts and Ideas. What was it called? The man who understood the world's patterns.
He saw reality's patterns. He saw the real patterns, you see. The real famous paper from 1991.
Yes.
Real patterns. And that's the, I suppose, that phrase is the key to a lot of what he was about how he invited us to think of the mind. And to think of many other aspects of reality too as real patterns. That are really there, but that are ones that we have to pick up on. So our contribution is detecting these patterns, seeing these patterns. People see different patterns, but the patterns are really there.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, maybe we'll have a little mind chat about Dennett sometime, perhaps in the future. But mind chat. Well, just generally, I suppose we've been off air for a little bit because we've had a couple of unavoidable postponements, but that's okay because it means we've got lots of exciting content coming up. We've still got our Christmas special to come, debate between Angela Mendelovici and Pete Mandick, which may end up as you said, Keith, being a midsummer debate, and
midsummer debate.
We might end up burning someone or something. I can't remember what that conversation was.
to the Wicker Man.
Oh, the Wicker Man. Yes, we're going to try and recreate that. But yes,
you're the Edward Woodward character.
On before I get myself in trouble. We've got Annika Harris coming up. We might talk about free will, panpsychism. Do we have a self? We haven't done much on a self, actually. Maybe the self might come up today. We've got Peter Godfrey Smith coming up. And Andy Clark.
In the autumn, I think we've got Andy, haven't we? That will be,
yes. So lots of exciting stuff going on. So I think, you know, we can all agree, despite our terrible production values, we are by far the best philosophy podcast. So if you want to help us achieve our domination of YouTube, please do make the small effort of liking and subscribing. Very easy to do. Help us get this content out. Or if you want to, we have a small number of kind Patreon supporters. You can support us just a couple of dollars a month, or pledge $10 a month to have a little chat after the episode as well. And yes, we're going to be using that.
Or 20 not to have a chat.
That would be a good incentive, wouldn't it? Hoping to use that money to hire someone to put together some clips compilations at some point. So hopefully that's going to emerge. Always too busy. I need to get around to doing that. But do you want to know what we've got today?
I do. Who have we got today, Philip?
Well, today, some very exciting. We are talking about psychedelics and what, if anything, they can teach us about mind and reality. Does that sound exciting?
Very interesting topic. Very interesting.
Well, I thought so.
So,
and we have two wonderful guests to talk to us about this with. Shall I bring them in?
Absolutely. And they will introduce themselves, I think. So
it sounded like you were unsure then. You were like, maybe. Yes, we are bringing...
I was trying to read your notes, so my apologies.
You're not prepared properly. Okay. Well, our wonderful guests, come on in. We have Sarah Lane Ritchie and Aidan Lyon. Welcome to Mind Chat.
Welcome to Mind Chat.
Thank you for joining us. Keith's got to look at his notes.
I was trying to see what I was supposed to do. Hang on, let's get this.
Well, I'm sure many of our, seeing as Keith's struggling to find his notes, I'm sure many of our guests will know who you are already, but just in case they don't, Sarah, would you like to tell us a little bit about yourself, what you're interested in, and maybe how you're interested in the topic of psychedelics in particular, but more generally as well?
Yeah, sure. Thanks. Thanks for having me. Joining you today from Princeton, New Jersey, after having just landed from a flight from India. So I'm a bit out of sorts at the moment, but we'll do our best. So my work is in the field of science and religion. It's a bit of an eclectic field, and it's drawing on work at the intersection of philosophy, theology, religious studies, and the various sciences. My own angle into this field has been at the intersection of neuroscience and psychology of religion and cognitive science, and then philosophical positions and some theological claims. I'll tailor this to the topic of psychedelics. My entry point into this sort of conversation came from my visceral reaction against what I call intuitive dualism. So sort of the intuition or the impulse towards dualism that is that I think Philip, you might actually own. And I wanted to really push back against that in my earlier work. And particularly within theological debates. So I have this book, Divine Action in the Human Mind, where I was basically pushing back against this claim that God can act in non-interventionist ways in the human mind because the human mind is something fundamentally different than the rest of physical reality. I wanted to reject that claim. And so through that, I started exploring various alternative metaphysical positions and positions within philosophy of mind, and became more and more interested in positions that are theologically open and friendly, perhaps, but are not the God of classical theism that many people will know, right? So exploring panentheism, and that's also when I started exploring the merits of panpsychism, and have written a lot on what I call spiritual technologies. And spiritual technologies I just am using to indicate anything that we intentionally do or use to make it more likely that we will experience something that we consider to be spiritually meaningful. or transformative. And psychedelics are one of these things, these spiritual technologies. Whether or not you think psychedelic experiences are truth tracking, whether or not you think that they are giving you any real insight into the nature of fundamental reality, they certainly are experienced as doing that. And so I find them immensely fascinating because of that. I actually enrolled in a clinical trial on psilocybin at Imperial College London, one of Robin Carr Harris's studies, because I wanted to experience firsthand like what people were talking about with psychedelics, and you know, that certainly informed my work in this area as well. And then finally, just to locate myself within the philosophy of mind space, I'm very open to a number of positions. I'm friendly to panpsychism. I'm also friendly to a variety of what I would call physicalist positions. Sorry, Philip. I think if I have any impulse or intuition, it's a monistic impulse and intuition. So I can land in panpsychism, or I can land in illusionism, or one or another of the more physicalist, naturalistic positions. But my avenue towards that landing point is not through dualism. It's not through the primacy of qualia. It's through this more monistic sort of intuition. So lots more I could say about that, but I'll let Aidan introduce himself.
Oh, that's really interesting. Loads of interesting stuff there that we should talk about more. And, you know, I'm sure we could have more than one conversation on this. Keith, were you about to say something? Or
I was just going to say that I'll just echo that sentiment that, yes, I think I've been very interested by the work of Sarah's work that I've been reading. But let me correct my earlier mistake by asking Aidan to introduce himself. Aidan, we know who you are, of course, and I'm sure many people will know you from your recent book that is just out, called Psychedelic Experience, I think. Is that right?
Psychedelic Experience, Revealing the Mind. Yeah.
You're right. So we know, and I'm sure a lot of philosophers will know you, but not all our listeners may be familiar with your work. So could you tell us a bit about yourself, please, and about your background, maybe perhaps how you got interested in this particular subject, and what shaped your thinking on it?
Sure. Thanks. So first of all, very happy to be here. Thanks for inviting me. In terms of my background, I'm actually a very odd philosopher. So at the moment, I'm working in the cognitive psychology unit at Leiden University as part of the PRISM lab. The PRISM is an acronym, PRSM, stands for Psychedelic, Religious, Spiritual, and Mystical. And so as a philosopher, I'm collaborating with scientists who think it makes sense to understand that kind of aggregate of experiences, whatever those terms mean, by the way, in a kind of holistic fashion, being open to taking them seriously, but also like maintaining the standards that we're familiar with of analytic philosophy and science and so on. And I got into this, so originally I was a mathematics undergraduate. I didn't know any philosophy. But then I found that mathematics was very narrow, and I wanted something more open to kind of, you know, for my career. And I found philosophy of mathematics was the perfect transition. And that took me into philosophy of probability. And I think that's when I first met Philip at the ANU. I was doing my PhD on philosophy of probability with Alan Hayek. So then a lot of my work has really been on the philosophical foundations of uncertainty. And then not only just the philosophical foundations, but applying that in the real world. So I've worked with the Australian government, for example, to help them manage extreme cases of uncertainty to protect them from emerging diseases, invasive diseases. So like the kind of thing that we've all experienced with COVID. Something big and scary comes along, you don't know what's going on, the uncertainty is high, but you've still got to make decisions. So I do a lot of consulting work helping with that. And then through personal experience, I got into psychedelics, and I found got me so fascinated by them was, one, they were improving my life enormously in all sorts of ways that, you know, I could talk about for hours. But then it wasn't just that I was feeling better. It was also, I was getting ideas and insights that could turn into publications or, you know, a software product that the government would use, right? And so there was external validation of these ideas that I was having, completely legally, by the way, here in Amsterdam, magic truffles are legal. So then I got really interested in trying to figure out like what's going on with the mind in these states. How are they both like profoundly healing and also seemingly enhancing creativity, although, you know, the science on that is tricky, and leading to mystical experiences, all these things. So I was just sort of fascinated by this question, like, what is this experience? What is a psychedelic experience? And then that got me into the book, and then yeah, here I am.
Fantastic. Well, I that leads actually quite nicely into what we have as our first topic. You've used the word psychedelic several times, and I guess when people hear that word, they probably immediately think of things like LSD or something like that. But I know you use the word in a rather precise way. Philosophers are always interested in getting clear on what we mean by our words, and it's certainly a good place to start, I think. So you have got a particular way, a particular conception of what a psychedelic experience is and what the word psychedelic means, which is, I think, you know, rooted in the history of the word. So could you begin by telling us about that? What does psychedelic mean, as you use the term, and what is a psychedelic experience in this sense? I think that would be really helpful.
Yeah. So, there's many ways to approach this. So one easy way, I guess, would be to look at the history of the word when it was first introduced, yeah. and in the concept that seemed that word was trying to seemingly be pointing to. So the term comes from Aldous Huxley and Humphrey Osmond in the 1950s, if I get the date period right. And they were sending these letters back and forth, trying to figure out what to call these substances that had grabbed all this attention, so psilocybin and LSD and so on. And they didn't like the names that were popular at the time, like hallucinogens or psychotomimetics, because they thought that these didn't really convey the essence or the sort of a general feature of these experiences. Like, it is true that you can hallucinate on these substances, but it's also true that you can have a trip without any hallucinations. And even when you do have hallucinations, it's often maybe not the thing that's getting people very excited about these experiences. It can, but not necessarily. So for those sorts of reasons, they were looking for a better word that would capture what they thought was the essence of the experience. And so they were trying all these different words out, and they landed on the word psychedelic, created out of the Greek terms psyche and delos or delun. And psyche, that can receive many different interpretations, right? But one natural interpretation would be the mind, as in, you know, how we understand psychology. But it can also receive interpretations of the self or soul, spirit, or so on. And when we look at Huxley and Osmond, they clearly had a concept like that. There was the mind, but then it was also a bit broader than how we might conceive of the mind in, say, for example, cognitive psychology today. And so they thought it was basically a hypothesis then, like that these drugs tend to cause those sorts of experiences that are somehow revealing a hidden part or aspect of the mind, something that we don't normally have access to, that's brought into conscious experience. And they're very clear about this. Osmond goes at great length. He describes all sorts of ways you can have these experiences. Like, he describes a long list of drugs, but he also talks about epilepsy, fasting, dervish dancing, chanting, meditation, yoga. It's clear that they have this idea that the notion of a psychedelic experience isn't tied to the particular substances that we're calling psychedelics. It's a broader notion. It's a little bit like what happened with aesthetic experience and aesthetic objects, like with John Dewey's work of naturalizing aesthetic experiencing, putting it on a continuum with regular experience and also even the experience of animals. And so that's kind of how I see psychedelic experiences. They're actually continuous with what we might call regular experience. But the experiences about the psychedelics, they really stand out to us because they're especially psychedelic, in the same way that when we go look at a fantastic piece of art in a museum or whatever, and we can be deeply moved by it, they stand out. But they're on a continuum with other experiences.
So there's no essential connection with drugs, legal or illegal. It's a certain type of experience that is revealing of the mind, of things that were hidden in your mind. So I could potentially just go for a walk on a beautiful day, and the combination of stimuli around me could just reveal something, yes, in this way of my mind. It's yes, a much broader concept.
and particularly diffusing your attention. So that's why walking or go staring at an ocean or like lots of light sparkling everywhere, the diffusing of your attention opens up the mind to insight.
I guess that's something we'll get back into, because it's the alteration and the regulation of attention that is crucial, isn't it, on your approach to that. I think that's really interesting, because there is a tendency, I think, to see these experiences as something like a distortion of what the mind should be doing, that is brought on by taking some substance that messes around with your neural functioning. But I think, as you see, they are part of normal experience.
Yes, but there is distortion. There's definitely distortion. So it's a bit like opening like a. So it depends on the intervention what exactly the distortion is, but you could liken taking a psychedelic a bit like opening up a can of soda. You reveal the soda inside, but you made it all bubbly and effervescent in the process. So it's you're revealing it, but you kind of changed its character. And we don't know the ways in which the mind's character is getting distorted in these with the revelations being occasioned by these interventions. We got some hypotheses about meditation might be a more stable, cleaner, gradual way of doing it. Psychedelics are more dramatic, and so they can give you like really good proof of concept experiences. That's a view that's out there. So they do a lot of distortion, but it's very attention grabbing, and it gives you the concept. Oh, my mind can be revealed, and then it's easy to find those experiences when you're meditating.
What do you think? Oh, sorry, come on.
Sorry, I just wrap that bit up. Would you say then that you think that pretty much everyone has psychedelic experiences at some point?
Yeah.
It's a universal thing.
And this very what I think is maybe the smallest psychedelic experience is it happens with the tip of the tongue phenomenon. Yeah. You know, so you're speaking, and then all of a sudden there's a word that you know, like you've used it governor so many times, right? But for some reason you don't have access to it.
Right.
So that's actually what I call a psychocryptic experience. Psychocryptic is the opposite of psychedelic. It's a mind, the mind is concealed. And in this case, you're aware of something that you don't have access to that you normally would. And of course, once you finally strain, stop all the straining and relax and give up, the word pops into your mind, right? That's a small psychedelic experience. It's a very, very small one. It's just the word. It's nothing like, your childhood memories being, flooding your experience. But it is on a continuum there.
Example you give of that, very innocuous but extremely powerful example, of course, is the one from Marcel Proust's famous novel, Alors Cherche du Tempo, where the taste of this little Madeleine, this little cookie dipped in fragrant tea, suddenly brings all of his childhood back to him and is the trigger for the entire novel. And that was a really powerful psychedelic experience, I guess, without taking anything more than a cup of tea and a biscuit.
Yeah. And when you read the full passage, it's also quite clear that whatever we mean by mystical, it's also a mystical experience. It's an extraordinarily profound experience that he describes.
So what do you think, Sarah? I know this maybe hasn't been what you've focused on particularly in your work, but do you have any thoughts about how we define a psychedelic experience?
Yeah, sure. It's a double-edged sword, this expansion of psychedelics. And I'm really torn on it. So on one hand, I do get worried about concept creep. So concept creep is this great term that's come up around kind of about our own therapeutic language, right? So this expansion of how we use the word trauma, for example. So if everything is trauma, is anything trauma, right? So that idea of concept creep is also applicable to the psychedelic space. So if we're calling everything psychedelic, does that detract from our ability to talk about potential, like particularly meaningful or transformative experiences, right? So that's like one edge of this double-edged sword, right? And on the other side, there's a much more positive spin that we can give on that, which Aidan has just like explicated very nicely. I also see a lot of this in Tanya Lerman's work. So she's an anthropologist out of Stanford who works a lot on religious experiences. She's not particularly religious herself, but she has done a lot of fantastic anthropological research on religious experiences and how they're cultivated and how people participate in the cultivation and the creation of these experiences, looking at the different dynamics that go into that. And that can be a really liberating and freeing idea, this idea that that psychedelic, like potentially transformative experiences that are worth calling psychedelic, are more available than we might think to people. I think there's a lot of value in that. And also seeing things on a continuum, I think we get into tricky territory when we start saying that there's a qualitative difference between an LSD-induced psychedelic experiences and something like meditation. Of course, like Sam Harris has this great line that that psychedelics were his gateway drug to meditation. I love that. It's like a perfect way to encapsulate, I think, what Ian's talking about here. And I think another way that I look at this is through the lens of Lori Paul's work on transformative experience. So she's a philosopher with like a dual appointment in cognitive science at Yale. And she looks at, she wants to define transformative experience as something that is an experience that so changes like who we are and what we know that we can't have access to that post-transformative experience person on the front end, right? So she's working more on the epistemology side of things, but that's another helpful way to think about what psychedelic experiences are, like transformative experiences. So basically I'm torn on this one, like how protective should we be about definitions of psychedelics? I tend to just distinguish between psychedelic experiences and mystical type psychedelic experiences, because that kind of is a subcategory, I think, the mystical type experiences.
Yeah, that's absolutely fascinating. So yeah, it just made me, both of what you've said made me think, I've just been taking for granted how I understand this term. And so, you know, yeah, philosophers do like to get, as Keith said, precise on what words mean, but also we're interested in, I suppose, whether these experiences reveal anything, you know, not just what they are, but whether we can trust them to learn about reality, the mind, or the reality outside the mind. And I know, Sarah, this is something you focused on in your work. It's a collection of essays called Is Consciousness Everywhere? In response to my work, and you had a really, really interesting essay on this topic about whether it can be rational to trust a mystical experience. So I was just thinking, maybe a way of making this, setting this up, making it very concrete. One of the boxes you tick on the psychological survey, testing whether someone is having a mystical experience, is something like you have a sense of a living presence in all things, right? Mm-hmm. That's one of the boxes you tick. So suppose I'm having a mystical experience and I have this deep sense that there's a living presence in all things, would it be rational for me to trust that experience? You know, trust that there really is this living presence in all things, as the experience seems to suggest? Or should I just think, oh no, it's just something funny going on in my brain that's giving me this delusion? What do you think about that question?
So probably completely predictably, I would say neither of those options. It'd be somewhere in the middle. I think what I said in that essay, something like these psychedelic experiences can be mutually reinforcing with a particular position in philosophy of mind. So I would be very hesitant to base my entire metaphysics, my entire worldview, my entire outlook on all things on one psychedelic experience, even if it was a mystical type experience. I would say, well, we should be cautious about that. At the same time, I would also be very hesitant to say that latching myself onto this most seemingly rational philosophical position or tradition that I can find is wise either. So I would be, I'm hesitant to sort of only rely on philosophical argumentation or on this first person experience of almost like a spiritual experience. So I think that these things need to exist in dialogue with each other. So I would say psychedelic experiences, mystical type experiences, can be like an incredibly valuable data point. So there's a lot of work on this in philosophy of religion and religious studies folks who are trying to understand what's happening in religious experiences. And I know obviously not all psychedelic experiences are religious in nature, but the adjacent literature in philosophy of religion and religious studies can be really helpful here. Like, how do we think about the informative value or lack thereof in these discrete temporal experiences that change everything for us and that have in them what is famously known as the noetic quality, the sense that whatever we are experiencing is more real, more true than anything else that we experience. in our lives. So it feels like the most true thing we've ever experienced. So I hold them in tension. So I do think that there are philosophical and even theological resources out there for people who have some predisposition or are in some way rationally inclined towards panpsychism or a naturalistic theism or whatever other metaphysical position is out there. If you're so inclined as to be interested in or inclined towards one of those positions, then you might find a lot of support for that position in a psychedelic experience. And in the same way, I really think that philosophy and to a lesser extent perhaps theology can be really useful for interpreting psychedelic experiences. So I take a very holistic view on this. I don't right. think that there is a binary here. That's not like a choice necessarily that needs to be made. If I have one commitment in life, it's probably a dispositional commitment to openness to what is and not wanting to close any doors prematurely and seeing what the options are and sort of always like positioning different data points, personal, neuroscientific, philosophical, psychological, always positioning these things in tension with each other.
That's really interesting. So more of a holistic approach. Well, let me try and maybe push back a little bit. So, I mean, yeah, so that term noetic feel, as I'm sure you know, comes from great William James's...
Yes. My patron saint, William James.
The variety of religious experience. Oh, he was a truly inspirational. I love James. But so this sense that the experiences are telling you something about reality itself outside of the experiences. But most of that, the chapter on mystical experiences or mysticism in that book is a psychological study trying to characterize them. But then at the end, he takes this question, would it be rational to trust these experiences, what they seem to be telling you about reality? And, you know, a lot of people say, well, of course not. You know, it's just something funny going in your brain. But James says, well, if you take that attitude, it looks like you're committing a kind of double standard, because we all think it's okay to form beliefs on the basis of our ordinary sensory experiences. You know, I believe there's a table here right now on the basis of my ordinary experiences. So if you're saying, and of course you could say, oh, well, we can check these with science, but ultimately science is justified through trusting your senses. If you can't just trust your senses, you can't get science going. Assume we're not in the Matrix or something. So if it's okay to trust our ordinary sensory experiences, but it's not okay to trust these mystical experiences, what they seem to be telling us about reality, maybe there's an onus on you to say, well, there's a double standard here. Why is it okay to trust one kind of experience but not the other? And I suppose just to connect it to, finally, to your holistic approach, you seem to be saying, well, we need different things working together. But I mean, a lot of our beliefs are just formed off sensory experience, you know, like, so why can't there be a belief, say, in living presence in all things that's just formed on the basis of mystical experiences? Someone who's meditated a lot, maybe, you know, regularly has this experience. Why can't, I mean, it connects just finally, as you're a theologian, connects a little bit Alvin Plantinga's work. You know, he's not so impressed by he's a traditional Christian, not so impressed by the argument. I mean, he has some time for the arguments for God, but he believes in God on the basis of his experience. And he says, you know, you believe it, that lots of stuff about the world around you on the basis of your ordinary sensory experiences. I believe in God and Christ and so on the basis of my religious experience. What's the difference? The onus is on you to tell me why it's rational in one case and not the other. What do you think of that?
Yeah. You know, it's funny you bring up Plantinga, because I was just thinking of him, because a lot of my work has actually been in a sort of like reaction against him, not him particularly, but like this idea that like, well, I just know that I know that I know, this like reformed epistemology position where this sort of like deep intuition, this deep sense that a particular sort of God is, that's enough, right? So on one hand, this is what you're saying is in fact descriptively true. When people have these particularly intense psychedelic experiences, they have this noetic quality. When you're having that experience, and oftentimes after the fact, you don't have an option but to experience it as real, right? So I think descriptively what you're saying is in fact just true, right? That like we don't really have much of a choice if you're in fact having, if you do have this noetic quality, because you just do perceive this experience as being true. It's like, I can't make myself not perceive the white door over there. I just do perceive it that way. So I think descriptively it's true. On the other hand, so partly for theological reasons, I want to not necessarily resist the idea that these sorts of experiences can be epistemologically informative or enough. I don't want to necessarily resist that, but I do want to encourage us to be appropriately critical of our own cognitive fallibilities. I view us as evolved biological organisms, and we get things wrong. So I think, again, a dispositional commitment. I think we should always be adopting a dispositional commitment to questioning our own intuitions, questioning our own interpretations and perceptions of reality. I do think that these experiences give us enough. They do, I think, warrant. I think they do warrant us taking them seriously and taking the implied metaphysics seriously. But I always just want to be humble, perhaps intellectually humble, about how much authority we're allowing them to have.
Maybe this is a good point to bring Aidan back in, because Aidan thinks that we can learn from these experiences, but then we're not learning about the fundamental nature of reality or about God or this sort of thing. We're learning about ourselves, I think. So yes, you think we can trust them to tell us something about ourselves properly interpreted. Can you, is that broadly right? And can you expand on it, please?
Yeah. It's broadly right. I would say that these questions about are these experiences showing us something about reality, they get really tricky because we're in this discursive tradition, right? And the experiences that we're talking about, at least an important subclass of them, are reported to be ineffable, and not just, people are at a loss for words, and then a very, very deep philosophical, very meaningful sense of ineffable. So these experiences outside, in a sense, are pretty much all of our regular experience. So if you get to those experiences by, say, taking a drug, you get there very rapidly, you're sort of plopped into that, and you've got this ontological shock, and then you've got these questions like, when you've come back to regular experience and your propositional thinking is back online, you can think, well, what the hell happened? What was that? What was, that felt real and then real. And like, so I experienced this. And of course, the experience itself was often not stable. You're coming in and out of it. And there's all sorts of things that are happening, right? And so trying to sort that out. And in contrast, that if you get to these experiences through a more gradual, disciplined approach or a spiritual practice, where it's incremental, and as you're going along developing these experiences, you're working with teachers and within a tradition or some kind of framework to help you make sense of those experiences. And then so there's more sense of continuity between these experiences and your regular life. And so it's a less, if you have that more gradual approach, it's less, disorienting. If done well, like there's lots of dangers with meditation as well, but if done well, you could argue that it's a safer approach, because along the way you're checking, does this make sense to the rest of my other beliefs? Is this stuff serving me? Is this helping me grow as an individual and flourish and so on? And if ever that's not the case, you can start thinking, well, maybe a different spiritual practice or a different framework or, a different way of approaching these things. And yet to Sarah's point, I think of it as like a triangulation problem. You're coming at this thing from multiple angles. You've got the experiential data. You've got all of, sort of your psychological data. So you can learn about your personal narratives and biases and how they may be shaping these experiences. And they're actually kind of spheres of projection rather than revelation. And then, wrapping that all together with sort of an analytic system of thought and empirical evidence. So it's all a coherent package. Putting all those things, I just don't know how else to do it, right? That just seems to be what we have to do. Mm-hmm. But being open to something unusual emerging out of this, because...
Could you maybe give us, trying to sort of cash that out, could you give us some examples of, you talk about things being revealed, and what's revealed, if I understand right, is essentially our unconscious aspects of our own minds. That's,
it depends on the kind of experience that we're talking about. If we're talking about like your typical psychedelic experience, sorry to interrupt, but it's otherwise we will just we'll get lost in the words, I think. So the kind of typical experience you have with like a medium dose of psilocybin and LSD, maybe you get to some sort of spiritual heights, but for like a lot of time it's people would face their trauma or something like this. It's more psychological in character, or maybe world oriented if you're at a festival or something like this. But then there are like experiences that are even like way higher than those, and I would tend to reserve the word mystical for those. Okay. And there, I would say they're quite a qualitatively different type of experience.
Okay.
It's quite easy to take a huge dose of a psychedelic and not get one of these very peak, high, however you want to characterize it, mystical experience. That different spiritual traditions have ways of characterizing exactly what that means. But with the language that we've got at the moment, I think that's a pretty good way of.
So that's when we get into this distinctive realm of what you call mystical experiences, which are revealing, disclosing something that is particularly hard to articulate and seems particularly important and profound. And so, but you do think, I am right in thinking that you think that a lot of experiences that you would call psychedelic are revealing something still very interesting, very important, but somewhat more mundane in that they're revealing unconscious contents of our own minds, kinds of mental processing that we don't normally have access to, memories. I mean, you gave the example of trying to recall something. And so you think that a major function, if you like, of psychedelic experience is to tell us something about ourselves.
Yes, absolutely. The reason why I was being so cautious is because of the ineffability of the very peak ones. I think then when we start asking, is something being revealed and is it about me, that I want to be much more cautious about those. But for the experiences that you were just describing,
I suppose when you get to this level of the mystical, I suppose the whole idea of myself and the self and the other begins to be challenged itself. So, but
yeah.
So then you think that we can, I mean, would this be right? That you think that psychologists and cognitive scientists could learn something, could gain some insights into the human mind from studying what happens during these experiences. Would that be fair?
Yeah, absolutely. And then having their own personal experiences if that feels right to them.
Could you perhaps give us let's take the obvious sort of challenge to this, I guess, which is, I mean, I suppose there are three ways of thinking about these things. One is that they reveal something about the deep nature of reality independent of us. One is that they don't reveal anything. They're just distortions of regular perception. And then there's this sort of middle position is that they're revealing something about, at least some of them are revealing something about our own minds that are normally hidden from us. Now, I suppose a challenge to that would be something like visual hallucinations, which are often regarded as central to this kind of experience. Yeah. Now, they don't seem to be revealing much of anything. They just look like pretty patterns. what could they be revealing to us?
Yeah, so it's a great question. I have a whole chapter on hallucinations. There's different kinds of hallucinations. It really depends on the context. You're referring to they're often described as low-level or geometric hallucinations. You get those with psychedelics, especially like a low dose of a psychedelic, close your eyes. That's a good way to have them. But then you can also have them through sensory deprivation and meditation and so on. So they come up through different means, and they have a striking similarity in their patterns. And it turns out we've got really good mathematical models of how those patterns are being generated in the primary visual cortex. So it's basically the brain's mechanisms for detecting edges and contours and things like this, kind of over-firing, over-guessing, right? And not getting the usual feedback that they would normally get. And so then that's basically what you're seeing. You're seeing your sort of the lower levels of your visual system struggle to make a guess or try to kind of create something out of nothing with its sort of prior expectations.
Aiden, can I ask a follow-up question?
Sure.
So I'm wondering how you position yourself vis-a-vis Chris Letheby, who I think it sounds like you hold a similar position as he does, where he wants to say that like psychedelic experiences can be epistemologically extremely valuable, but in a less metaphysical sense, right? Except maybe when you're talking about the contingency of the self, right? So in his book, he talks a lot about sort of like the quieting of the DM or the default mode network. And I'll let you explain that if you want. And basically what Chris wants to say, I think, is that the psychedelic experiences does in some way give us more access to reality, if you will, because it quiets our cognitive distortions of ourselves as being this like super distinct entity in relationship to the rest of the world. So I'm like, how would you position yourself within his thought? Yeah.
Yeah. So I like Chris's view, right? But I have a broader view. I think that he got half of it right. The other half is that psychedelics can sort of, they can take you deeper into experience, right? So especially when you're using them in ceremonial contexts where there's shamanic practices or tantric practices. And you look at what's happening in a lot of these spiritual traditions, there's a deliberate kind of programming of the mind, to constructing experience. Like Philip's question about hallucinations, it's not clear sometimes if these things are hallucinations. You can, like, through deep meditative practices, you can create these extremely vivid, rich visual experiences of deities. And you just learn the deity, study it, and then you create this thing, and you can then absorb yourself into the deity, and you are, you know, that god, and you absorb all of its qualities and whatever. So that you can think of it as there's two directions. There's a kind of stepping back from experience. It's sometimes called phenomenal opacity. You're sort of noting the representational character of your experience, and that may not match reality. But then there's phenomenal transparency, which is the kind of thing that happens when we go deeper into experience, when we, you know, sort of the painting here, you could look at it as this paint on the canvas, or you could see it as an image, right? And you can see through it. So psychedelics can help you, I think, go in both directions, and actually not just either or, but like both at the same time. And if I understand Chris's work correctly, he tends to focus more on the opacification side, the stepping back, which makes a lot of sense, I think, because, this takes a while to explain, but I think there's a sense in which you could say that there's a higher or sort of more profound mystical experiences associated with being able to do that move traditionally, but it's very messy, and a lot of people would disagree with that. But yeah, that would be my take.
That's fascinating. So I'm interested in the ineffability, actually, because I mean that was William James's other characteristic, the noetic feel and the ineffability, meaning you can't communicate these experiences. You can't sort of put it in a vocabulary that people would understand if they haven't had the experiences. And some people say, oh, well, that means it's sort of meaningless, or it's just, you know, an experience. But combined with the noetic feel, the idea for people having mystical experiences, you can both correct me if I'm wrong, they do seem to be perceptions of reality. It's just something you can't communicate to people who haven't had the experience, as Louis Armstrong allegedly said, if you ask what jazz is, said, if you have to ask, you'll never know. William James referred to these as the more, right? The M-O-R-E, the more. So there is an idea that there is something true about reality we're getting at here. It's just that you can't communicate it. But I suppose coming back to you, Sarah, I suppose if they are do have this ineffable characteristic, then it's perhaps hard to see how you can relate them to, coming back to theology, for example, more concrete propositional claims of specific religions that you can communicate to other people. So maybe there's a sort of disconnect between the ineffable nature of the mystical experience, and what do you think about that?
Yeah, all of James's sort of characteristics of religious experiences that he goes through, and I think that most of the literature on psychedelics also picks up. And I think the ineffability one is probably the one I'm the most bearish on. So it's the one that I'm the least convinced by, but I'm not so worried about it, right? So I think there are a lot of experiences in life that we have struggles around when we're trying to communicate them. Falling in love, having a child, having an experience of awe, wonder, beauty. There are a lot of experiences in the world that are hard to fully capture in language, but we do our best, you know, and we kind of have a sense of what someone is talking about, even just saying, I had this really powerful experience and it's hard for me to describe. It's a bit like this. It's a bit like that. It's a bit like that, but combined into one and then intensified by like a, you know, a hundredfold or something. Like, we have ways of describing other ineffable experiences. in, you know, perhaps clumsy language, but enough to indicate to other humans who are evolved in the same way that we are, who have also had their ineffable experiences, you know, we kind of know what someone's getting at when they say, I can't describe what it was like to fall in love with this person. Most of us, or many of us, kind of have an idea of what they're talking about. So I'm actually not as concerned about the ineffability characteristic as I am about the perhaps like the noetic one. Just to follow up on that, you were asking about the theology side of things. Like, we have these like doctrines and concepts that we put around experiences, and they become very codified and very specific in particular religions. What I would want all theologians to do, regardless of their tradition, is to become much more humble and much more willing to accept the ineffability of the experiences that they're trying to capture. I mean, of course, there's this whole evolution of religion, evolutionary approaches to the psychology of religion. We have a lot of great work now on like how religion evolved and how a lot of, you know, a good guess about how religion evolved is that, you know, we were basically trying to, humans were trying to capture experiences exactly like the ones we're talking about. And then there's a lot of other dimensions of psychology of religion and evolutionary terms as well, of course. But I would want, yeah, I think in general, theologians need to chill out a bit on the specificity that they want to attach to their theological claims. And they should be more aware and humble about the ineffability of the experiences that undergird a lot of their doctrines.
Could I just interject? I think I always get a bit worried when people talk about ineffability, because everything's ineffable to a cat.
Yes.
Or a dog.
Yes.
You know, and you know, the richer your conceptual repertoire, the less is ineffable. And it's a, you know, it's a you know, truism, you know, that as you gain new concepts, you can articulate more, you know, and perhaps even you can sharpen your abilities to detect things. You know, wine tasting is an example, yeah. Smell and so on. So the idea that there's stuff that is in principle ineffable, I think, is a very, very bold claim. And I would always be cautious of that. There's loads of stuff that's ineffable for us, given our current conceptual repertoires. And I worry sometimes that there's a sliding between people saying that's ineffable, meaning I can't articulate it, yeah, and saying that's something that the human mind can never properly grasp or explain. Mm-hmm. And I think we need to be careful.
That's right. I agree. I totally agree with that. I mean, I think that in one sense, me describing what this table is like me experiencing this table is in one sense ineffable, right? We're never going to be fully able to articulate and verbally express our experience of anything. So I don't view this as a qualitative difference between psychedelics and any other experience in life. Yeah. I think there are varieties, there are kind of gradations of difficulty when it comes to verbally articulating the nature of different experiences.
But isn't it a bit different in the sense that, I'm trying not to get to qualia that we'll start having an argument, me and Keith, but you know, people tend to think with read experiences or something, there's something you can't communicate unless you've had that particular experience. Whereas there's other things where, yeah, okay, cats don't do mathematics, but there isn't in the same way a particular kind of experience you've had to have in order to get that knowledge.
That I would agree with. And it's because of my engagement with Laurie Paul's work on transformative experience. And she's coming at this from a very analytic kind of technical angle where she's basically just looking at what can you actually know if you have not had an experience. And she is these days so one way of looking at this is through the psychology of empathy, right? So can you empathize with other selves, including your own future self, like if you have not already had an experience yourself? Like, there are limits to what we can actually know if we have not had a particular experience. But I'm not sure, so I love that. And I'm not sure it's particularly interesting because I have never been Philip Goff sitting in that particular office with his particular set of life circumstances. So in some ways, there's an ineffability about, there's a way in which I cannot access, you know, what you access. And so you kind of triangulate from what I know, what it's like, you know, I know what it's like to be an academic. I know what it's like to be a human being, you know? So you kind of try and pinpoint what it's like to be Philip Goff, but no, of course I cannot ever fully know what it's like to be Philip Goff without actually being Philip Goff. So,
you're welcome to take over my body, my existence, if you want. be like, what's that film? Being John Malkovich.
Yeah. You can, I'm super sleep deprived and I have a newborn at the moment, so I would actually love to trade bodies.
Maybe I'll rethink that. Our kids are a bit older, finally getting a bit of sleep. Bring Aidan. But just if people want to ask questions, we will have some Q&A shortly. So if people want to put Q, if you want to ask a question, put Q in the chat and then ask a question and then we'll bring in some questions. But I mean, maybe we can talk more generally. Go on.
Let's stick to our plan. Shall we move on to the other topic we were going to talk about, which is psychedelics and philosophy? Because I know Aidan has some, I'm sure Sarah has some thoughts on this too, but I'll address it first to Aidan. I know in your book you have a chapter on how psychedelics can, how they can be a psychedelically informed philosophy. Mm-hmm. Now that sounds interesting, provocative. I guess a lot of people would say that's exactly what you don't need in philosophy. You need to think analytically and rigorously and logically and rationally, and you don't want to have any distortions to your thinking processes. But you think it can be a great asset to the philosophical thinking. So tell us about that.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, look at how much we rely on intuition and insight, you know? So if you really think about it, when you start at a problem, you often just kind of like think about the problem and just sit there and just sort of hope something comes up. And then if something comes up, you check it with all your analytic resources, right? Like, how does this fit in? They have arguments, how do other people react, blah, 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 blah. So, with that moment of waiting, there are just so many different methods and practices to make that more productive, more effective. And so, you know, there's not really, it's just you're getting more information and you're getting more of the thing that you want. Like, we want to have insights. Like, we want to at least have the feeling that we've got a solution to our problem, right? Maybe we're wrong, but that's better than just sort of being stuck on it. And so getting more of that, and so long as you're managing it, it's not getting out of control, it can be, it's like pouring gasoline on the philosophical fire.
So that sounds, let's maybe distinguish two things. That sounds like what you're saying is that it can help you do the things that you were trying to do already.
Yeah.
And it can help you to come up with good ideas, good intuition pumps, as Dennett would say, the good counterexamples, good arguments perhaps, which you then sort of analytically check afterwards. Okay, so you have this brilliant idea and then you try. So that's that it's like a sort of stimulant to doing the kind of things that we already do. But do you think it can do more than that? Can it introduce a new type of philosophy and type of philosophical thinking? Can it actually enable us to do new things that we weren't doing before?
Yeah, I think so. So, it depends on how we view the current state of philosophy. But if we think it might be over-constrained and maybe trapped in old ways of thinking and maybe not, you know, there's obviously a huge debate about philosophical progress, how to measure it, what does it mean, and so on. But maybe there could be more progress. Certainly in the scientific research about psychedelics and meditation, we could use a lot more philosophical input in that space, I think. Traditional philosophy is coming over. I think what happens is that I think it really depends on the person. For me, it's opened me up to say way more flexibility in my philosophical views, especially things like metaphysical views. But I think Sarah was saying something like this before, that I can just try on different hats. I can just check from different angles and I'm not like wedded to them. I mean, I'm not perfect at this, but that's something that's become better as I've sort of done this kind of work. And I get way more enjoyment out of philosophy. I find it more meaningful. And that's just my personal example of how I think it would be very different for all sorts of people. It really depends on what you're doing and your personality makeup and things like this.
Philip was trying to sort of use this to raise our hands. So let me just try and do a little bit the same. But I think
caught me.
Dennett's on my mind very much at the moment. And I think one thing that he was trying to get us to do was to look at the philosophical landscape from a different perspective. Yeah. His books are quite discursive. There are lots of examples, lots of thought experiments, intuition pumps. There are lots of suggestive passages. And some people found this, I think, annoying. They thought, where are the rigorous arguments with premises and so on? And it wasn't, that wasn't what he was doing. He was trying to get people sort of, who he thought were in the, to use a familiar phrase, in the grip of a picture, to yeah. try and see things from another angle. He was saying, come over here and look at it, look at the landscape from this position. Don't stay trapped in the, you know, in the grip of these intuitions that you can't change. And that resonates very much with what you've just said, I think, that yeah. it's about opening, if it, insofar as it's like what is being revealed maybe is alternatives.
Yeah.
Alternative ways of thinking. I mean, by heavens, we need that. It doesn't necessarily mean that you then go and endorse these alternatives, but you appreciate them.
Yeah.
You understand, you stand in someone else's shoes, you appreciate that perspective. And then maybe you take that back to your own and that somehow enriches or changes or whatever your own. But I'm
philosophical empathy is a little way.
That's a nice way of putting it. I like that. And yeah. again, that was something that Dennett was very keen on. He said you had to know your yeah. opponent's position. You had to be able to describe your opponent's position in such a way that they would say to you, I couldn't have put it better myself. Yeah. Before you go on to criticize it. But that requires, as you say, opening up. I mean, perhaps even emotionally, we get very emotionally attached Absolutely. To our views. They are our views. They are our little flags that we've waved and that we're known by these labels.
Yeah. Actually, can I jump in there? So because
my
background in uncertainty is very relevant here, because I think sometimes what's driving a lot of that is our natural intolerance of uncertainty, which is it's a well-documented phenomenon. It drives all sorts of mental health problems, all sorts of problems, right? Mm-hmm. And I think it's why sometimes debates in philosophy get vicious. And I see this in statistics as well. I was so sort of stunned when I was going to statistics conferences about how vicious they are. They were more vicious than the philosophy ones.
Really?
Oh. Yeah, like almost violent. It was pretty crazy. And I think, so what's happened in both cases, what we're dealing is with like the absolute foundations of uncertainty, some sort of framework that we, you know, we're personally motivated. We're not like brains and bats talking philosophy. Mm-hmm. We're real people with emotions and whatever. And we're brought into, we find ourselves drawn to certain philosophers' ideals or whatever. So there is, we've got skin in the game. Absolutely.
That's fantastic. I think that's very salutary.
I remember, so when I was a teenager, I took some psychedelics, and one experience I vividly remember is watching the BBC News and the music at the start. You know, they have this really dramatic music, and just vividly seeing how ridiculous it was to have sort of dramatic theatrical music to reading out information. Do you know what I mean? And like before, I'd sort of got so used to that, I thought that, I think what was going on was, you know, I'd got used to that and thought that was a natural and inevitable. That's what you have with the news. You have this music. And then breaking through that sort of conditioned way of seeing reality just opened me up to see how ridiculous it was to have, like, you know, this. Yeah. And so that's where I see, you know, talk of mind expanding or something. And I wrote a little bit about this in my last book, Why. It's sort of, you have those conditions. I mean, the most extreme version, I suppose, would be extreme racism, where you just see that ethnic group as having these characteristics and you see them in this. But we all, in some subtle ways we don't realize, don't we, you know, project our own narrow perspective on things, and we see that as though it's reality. And I think what psychedelics can do is sort of, you guys know much more about this than me, but in my own sort of thinking about this, break through those conditioned ways of seeing reality and just open us up to and so that's, you know, not necessarily appealing to anything mystical, but that they can be, in a sense, really mind, and it can be scary. Obviously, it's very, very, we should emphasize that it can be very, very dangerous, because I had some terrible scary experiences as well, because you lose all your moorings and you're suddenly at sea. And but I think that can be also profoundly,
maybe you're no longer confident that the nature of your experiences is completely revealed to you.
that would be a very strong drug that would make me think that. but
sorry, I had to do that.
Yeah, it was just on the ineffability thing again. I would add to that with that. I think maybe a bit of a, I'm a fan of ineffability. I actually think it's the way I like to think of it is it's a very useful concept for philosophers and scientists to really contemplate and meditate on. Because when you do that, I think if you really allow, because I think there's somethingness that really hates that idea that some things are ineffable. And so if you just sit with that and just explore what happens, if you're just going to be okay with this idea that some things are ineffable for a bit, you don't have to believe anything. You can let it go afterwards, but just sit with it for a bit and then see what you think. A tremendous way of opening up. Yeah. Sorry. Go ahead.
The three of you are using language that gets at one of the best, most valuable qualities of people who've had psychedelic experiences that are pretty intense. And it's what I call like wisdom. Wisdom is a fuzzy word because, you know, it's just hard to pinpoint. What do we mean by that? Like, there's not much of a literature on wisdom. You know? So, but I would say there is a sort of wisdom that often is attendant to these experiences or the way that people live their lives after they've had these experiences. And it's wrapped up with empathy, it's wrapped up with kindness, and it's wrapped up with like humility, but it's a sense of like an enhanced like kind of perspective on things, like a zoomed out perspective, like you were saying, Philip, like the ridiculousness of the BBC music, right? Like there's a sense of like, okay, I'm not like super immersed in my localized experience. Like I can kind of zoom out a bit and have some like wisdom and kindness. I think also this gets at what you were obliquely referring to about like the meanness of philosophy conferences. Like philosophers can be so mean to each other. It's amazing to me, actually. I was like almost cruel sometimes. And that, you know, I think that is actually one incredible good that psychedelics can offer the philosophy community in particular, is sort of a way in which people can experience their own fallibility and the limitations of any particular view and recognize kind of like the big picture of things a little bit. I mean, of course, the other side of that is that like psychedelic experiences, as Aidan was saying, can be incredibly stimulating and generative. I mean, it is, there are so many anecdotes about like brilliant scientific insights and artistic insights coming out of psychedelic experiences. For those who haven't had psychedelic experiences, it's sort of like when you're trying to figure out a problem. For me, it's always about like writing the perfect thesis statement in a paper or something. Like you're trying to figure it out. And really what you need is something that will just like shake up the snow globe. And, you know, again, it's not only in psychedelics that this happens. For me, I'll be taking a shower and all of a sudden I'm like staring at the wall for 5 minutes as I'm like, my brain is just like writing this perfect sentence in my head or something. Similar sorts of things. They're just like, you know, they shake up the snow globe. But then after the fact, you do go through life with this kind of this, yeah, more of a sense of, you know, empathy and kindness. And I would like to call that wisdom.
Yeah, I completely agree. Yeah, maybe that's like the most, Keith, your question before was about, is this a different way of doing philosophy? Like maybe that's the sort of, maybe the most distinctive. It's a kinder, more empathetic way of doing philosophy.
Interestingly, I mean, would you say that, I was just thinking that I'm not sure that the formal structure of academia is something that I think it encourages that competitiveness. Absolutely. That meanness. Think we're not goodness knows how you restructure it, but I do think there's something about modern academia where everybody is striving for a limited number of positions and everybody's ranked and graded and they have to secure, you know, points from publications and so on, and it's not surprising people are so on edge mean to each other. We're not fostering it. We're not creating an environment where wisdom can flourish.
Now, strangling
systems. Now, and I mean, I take your point that psychedelics can happen, but we're not fostering an atmosphere. I mean, I don't suppose anybody would recommend giving academics loads of drugs, but it would be great if we could create a formal structures that tended to foster that kind of openness and that kind
Totally agree.
How we do it, I don't know, but
that was the point of that chapter, actually. Psychedelic philosophy is to, you don't need to use psychedelics for this.
Yeah.
And there's all these things from just simple meditation practices that we could teach graduate students, to teaching, you know, some are just naturally able to look at art and appreciate it and have it the artist's perspective. Some need to be taught that. When you're taught that, that's a tremendous skill that can help you, you know, opens up empathy. I mean, this is, as far as I'm not a Kantian scholar, but this is how I understand why Kant was so interested in aesthetics. So we've got these things there. We just got to package them, list, like write them in a list and say, learn these, and then that's a start.
The trouble is that as soon as we did that, they would people would start trying to grade the outputs of this process, and you know they have to have some sort of metric for how well you've done on, you know, on meditation and openness, and where your students now, could it be graded as what percentage of openness have they? And you have to write reports on how more open, and people immediately then start trying to game the system as they do.
But then I think that's a problem in the teaching, because I think it's not replacing one with the other, right? It's these two ways of approaching philosophy, integrating them. You can totally grade this stuff and, you know, get students to write essays about their meditative experiences and how they relate to Nietzsche or whatever. We know how to evaluate that.
I sometimes wonder whether something even more radical isn't needed, and maybe this pursuit of this is something that actually is not best done within the walls of academia.
Maybe. I just put it there as like, hey, this is an option, and I think...
Yeah, no, I'm not going to criticize that, but maybe something even a bit more radical is needed. And, in a little way, maybe things like this, which we're not speaking within the walls of academia, we're speaking to a wider audience and trying to... Yeah. I think that's... If we want it, I mean... If we're just cultivating this wisdom and this openness within the small group of people in the philosophy department, well, that's no great. You know, it needs to be much, much, much wider in society.
Yeah. I think anything that can help us embrace uncertainty, I think, is so important. I think, you know, people sometimes say, this point Hume made, I thought, some people sometimes say, why are philosophers wasting time thinking about, oh, I could be in the Matrix, you know, these stupid skeptical possibilities. But I think it's all about realizing how much uncertainty is built into the human situation. And I think this can be important because, for example, even with very well-confirmed science, there's some kind of doubt, even with sort of man-made climate change, there's some kind of doubt. And then when people hear, oh, there's doubt about this. Oh, well, I'm not going to believe it if there's doubt. Mm-hmm. I only believe things that are certain. But then once you realize, actually, we don't even know whether the table exists in front of me, when you realize there is uncertainty inherent, then I think you more correctly evaluate evidence. You know, people are sometimes surprised, you know, I spend my life defending panpsychism, but I think it's more probable than not, but I think there's a hell of, I wouldn't be surprised if it was false. Maybe I'm 55% confident. I've still got it. Yeah. I even think there's a small chance Keith's view is right. You know, so we've got to embrace the uncertainty of the human epistemological
situation. Philip, I think that's exactly right. I was arguing with my partner about Kant's transcendental, he's a Kant scholar, and I was arguing with him about Kant's transcendental idealism, which I think is pretty ridiculous. But like the fact of taking it seriously is, I think, a very good intellectual and even spiritual discipline. Like there's something instrumentally like crucial about being able to take seriously and really like plumb the depths of positions that might seem ridiculous. Like the fact of engagement itself is really, I think, good for us as humans.
It's intellectual fitness. It's exercising oneself. It's creating that flexibility so that those intellectual joints are supple. Mm-hmm. I don't know. Yeah. I want to take that metaphor too far, but
on that, I like the idea that mathematics is a mystical practice.
Oh, wonderful.
Because I'm biased, but my experience of it was that you get a feeling of what certainty is like and how it can be illusory, because you can create these proofs of theorems and they seem completely right to you. And then someone points out to you that you made a very subtle mistake, and having that kind of exposure of you're so confident, it's so completely clear. And then it turns out you're absolutely wrong afterwards. That feeling, you get this feeling of certainty, and that kind of helps calibrate the rest of your belief system. Well, it can, you know, obviously I won't make any comments about mathematicians, but you get the point. I think if you relate to it in the right way, I think it can help calibrate your epistemic situation.
One of my colleagues, I have to bring in here, one of my colleagues in theology, Karen Kilby, a very influential Catholic theologian, who her work is on the mystery of religion and theology, but she thinks mystery isn't about sort of, oh, we don't know, and removing knowledge. Often she points out advances in knowledge can reveal how incomprehensibly bizarre something is. And she's also a mathematician, and she gives the analogy of, you know, Cantor's mathematics of the infinity which she goes into very beautifully, and thinking that wasn't moving to more ignorance. It was an advance in our knowledge. But this advance in our knowledge, you know, that there can be bigger and smaller infinities, just made us appreciate how baffling this phenomenon is. And so that's how she sees good theology. It's advancing our knowledge in a way that reveals the profound, unfathomable nature of God, or whatever you're focusing on. What do you think about the psychedelics and theology, Sarah? Do you think this is the potential for mysticism was like to help?
Yeah, totally. Yeah, and this is honestly the theology side of things is actually the easiest. I think like the epistemological debate around psychedelics is more complicated if you take a naturalistic view of the world. As soon as you bring God into it, I should qualify this by saying as soon as you bring in some sort of theistic version of God, that where God has some level of like agency and is in some way personal, things become a lot easier because we have a whole literature built up around how to understand revelation or experiences of God as an agential kind of reaching out of God to the human. And so as soon as we're talking about theology, well, then I just call psychedelics a spiritual technology, where of course you have to, contextualize the psychedelic experience within the overall epistemological framework and authority structure of tradition and scripture and community and all this stuff. But like, I think I'm in print as saying that psychedelics are no different than liturgies, than set prayers, than the smells and bells of the high churches, than the fog machines in dramatic music in evangelical churches in the U.S. is all part and parcel of the same thing. So as soon as we're talking about theology, I think the epistemological conversation is actually much easier, though I think almost no religious people would agree with me on that.
That's amazing. Did you want to say something, Aidan?
Oh, just real quick. I was going to say that fits very neatly with where like a lot of thinking is on set and setting.
Yep.
So instead of just thinking of substances as being psychedelics, we should be thinking of the triple, the substance, the set, and the setting.
Yep.
And you just see this in so many different spiritual traditions and churches. They put all this work into the setting. It's surrounded by artwork and music and incense and things like this. And it's because they're designing an experience.
And so the substance might be relatively, maybe a placebo would work given the right setting.
So there is an idea. So one big idea out there that I really like is that they're super placebos. So they do. They have a variety of effects, but one of the effects is that they enhance the placebo effect by making you more suggestible.
Yeah.
Which explains why you so often you see these psychedelics seem to work best in ceremonial settings, right? So where they probably don't think of it in these terms, but the idea is like, okay, we're going to kind of open up the person, right? Make it more suggestible, ramp up that placebo effect, and then we're going to put a particular program into them that we think is going to help them.
Yeah.
And that program is going to work through the placebo mechanism, however that works, and then that's the healing process.
Well, I mean, perception is shot through with all experiences shot through with interpretation. So manipulate the interpretation in the right way, and you know, relatively small changes in experience could have large cognitive effects, couldn't they? So.
Yeah, exactly. Sometimes what you need to do is focus on your breath and be in that setting, and you can change your consciousness quite quickly.
Yeah. No,
this is all fascinating. I could talk about this all day, but we do have some questions here. So maybe if you have a little bit more time, we could consider some questions going in order here. Mark O'Brien, disagreeable me on Twitter, friend of the show, asks, what do you make of the fear that psychedelics might so alter our minds as to make us believe things that are not true? This is a good point, isn't it? We've been focusing on the positives here, but what about these worries that I think have been coming up a lot in the chat, actually? What do you guys think about this?
Yeah, anytime I talk about spiritual technologies at all, and especially when I talk about psychedelics, the manipulation question always comes up. So how do we know that in engaging in any spiritual technology, and here is the case is psychedelics, how do we know that in having these sorts of experiences is not just going to allow us to be so manipulated by brain chemistry or whatever else that we're going to be led far, far astray? I would say two things. One is that you're opening yourself up to manipulation anytime that you have any experience in the world. So anytime you go to a concert, anytime you go to a film or let yourself sink into some powerful music, you're opening yourself up to having experiences that are in some degree powerful, and that have stand some chance of shaping the way that you think about the world. Falling in love is actually a good example here too, because there are probably very few things that can be so cognitively distorting as falling in love, because it does kind of change it can distort your reality in a way that is both incredibly good, but it also maybe is not the most accurate, depiction of the way that things are. So one is that you're always, it's not an option to not be manipulated in life, or to avoid being misled in life. That's not an option. So the question then becomes, well, how do you responsibly handle that problem? And this is where the holistic dimension comes back in, right? So if you're taking things in the whole, in the round, what are ways of triangulating this experience vis-a-vis the scientific literature, philosophical traditions, perhaps religious traditions, if that's your thing, and checking it against the experiences of people you consider to be experts in various domains. So the two-pronged approach: one, being manipulated. Not being manipulated is not an option. And two, you've got to draw on other resources.
I want to bring Aidan in, but just briefly, just made me think of another thing William James said in a different context in his paper, The Will to Believe,
yes,
where he considers these very strict, what Clifford was the guy in his day, yes. Bertrand Russell said similar things, only believe when you've got evidence appropriate. And he said, well, okay, avoiding error is one important thing, but you might also miss out on truth.
Yes.
So you've got it's a balancing act. You can't, if you could completely avoid error by not having any beliefs, but sometimes you might want to take a risk if there's a chance you'll get more.
Yeah, James's Will to Believe, I think, is the best thing that's ever been written on this question that was just posed. So I highly recommend that paper.
He later thought it should have been called The Right to Believe, which I think is more appropriate. It's about whether it's in cases of uncertainty, can it be rationally acceptable, have the epistemological right to believe. And
you also need to take care that you have that what your live options are. Make sure you're not restricting those arbitrarily. Maybe there are more
options than you think. He's got some strict criteria, hasn't he? So it's not just believe what the hell you want. In certain limited contexts, he thinks it might be rational to
One of those is that it should be a live option, but live options are determined by all sorts of contingent things.
I would want to modify his view and bring in evidence there.
To determine
what the live options are. So he seems to say, Islam isn't a live option for me. You know, he's living over 100 years ago because it's just too alien to my culture. I'm not used to it. But that seems to make it subjective. So I would want to modify his view and think that the live options are more determined by there's a certain amount of, if there's a 30% chance this is true, well, then it's a live option. But it might be that you, like John Hick, think the world is religiously ambiguous, that some things suggest God, some things suggest atheism. You've got fine-tuning on one hand, suffering on the other. And maybe in those cases of uncertainty, maybe both God and atheism would be live options and we could take the... Anyway, this is a discussion for another day.
That view in a book?
Well, it might be slightly different. Anyway... Aidan, do you want to say anything to Mark's worry about things being led astray?
So I agree with all of that, although I think I'm maybe a bit more concerned about it, because if you take into account like what's going on in the world socially, culturally, politically, I don't think I'm the only person saying this, that like our institutions seem to be falling apart. Trust in communication seems to be, at an all-time low. We've dumped the internet and social media on these species that, as my best understanding of it, the evolutionary game theory literature on cooperative behavior requires that there's structures and communities, that there's limitations on the sort of communication channels, and we've just completely flattened our communication structures. Mm-hmm. Our institutions are evaporating, whatever. And then if there's an explosion of sort of psychedelic use, in a culture that doesn't really have the right frameworks and containers for that yet, I'm concerned. And then of course there's AI coming in as well. I don't know what to put probabilities to put on anything, but I'm alarmed, I would say.
It's an argument as well for the addition, like the intentional addition of philosophers in these neuroscientific and psychology studies on it's the whole reason for PRISM existing, I think. Is PRISM Is it Prism? Yes, it's Prism.
Prism, yes, yes.
Yeah. Prism definitely needs to exist because I'm concerned, I think as you are, Aiden, about the explosion of research on psychedelics, this renaissance that we're in, being so heavily dominated by neuroscientists and psychologists who are not trained in philosophy. And so I think the additional, like the intentional inclusion of philosophers in the research studies themselves is incredibly important.
Yeah, urgent, I would say, because the world is picking up, you know, they're getting this news for the, you know, they're getting this information for the news media and it's just exploding. And we need, I mean, it's one of the reasons, motivations for writing the book is to try and bring some clarity in thinking about these things. So there's some sort of map of what to, you know, how to navigate it. Oh, wow, so we need more. That was just a, you know, a step.
That's really important stuff. Okay, maybe one or two more questions. We've got Pooja Sani here, another friend of the show. Can we have a science of psychedelics where we might explore the therapeutic implications? I mean, this is something we haven't talked about, actually, isn't it? As my understanding, correct me if I'm wrong, there is the evidence, as we've started having a lot legal research on, in the US in particular, the mental health benefits in a huge range of conditions are enormous. Is that right?
That's right. And I've enjoyed not having to talk about the therapeutic implications because the therapeutic implications of psychedelics has been the bulk of this recent research or the recent renaissance on psychedelics. It's only in the last few years that philosophers have started really engaging with this newer research that's come out in the last 20 years or so. I just take it for granted that obviously there's, you got to be careful because there are certainly mental health conditions that would indicate that one should not do psychedelics, even if they were illegal everywhere. Like, just, you know, you've got to be careful. But disclaimers always. The bulk of the research has actually been on the therapeutic implications. It's only in the very recently that we've been starting to talk about the metaphysical and philosophical implications of these things, at least in this current wave. But Aiden, you can speak more to that.
Yeah, I mean, I completely agree. I think it's a bit of a Wild West situation at the moment. We're still just discovering what's going on. It's very early days. Sometimes the results are overstated, I think. But the research is exploding and the quality is going up. So, you know, we're starting to get better and better evidence. And, you know, it seems to be increasingly convincing that psychedelics, when used in the right, way, can treat just this extraordinary range of mental conditions, let's say. Everything from OCD and depression to, I forget them all now. There's so many of them. Addiction to other drugs. There was another one on one that came out recently on body dysmorphia, I think. So it's just, but it looks like that basically any kind of mental health condition that involves sort of being stuck or rigid in some way.
Yes, that's right.
If you can kind of get a bit more flexibility and movement in that, you open up the system with all its negative feedback loops, you're loosening them up, and then it makes it possible, more possible for, you know, new behavior to be encoded, new habits to be.
Yeah. So the really nice metaphor here is if you're sledding down a hill, like a snow-covered hill, right? And you've got a track, right? That's been forged by the sled going down a particular path. And it becomes very difficult for your sled to get out of that little path going, you know, in the snow. And what psychedelic experiences do is it shakes things up and it makes it more possible for you to forge a new path. There are neural reasons for this, but especially with addictions, eating disorders, PTSD, and depression, psychedelics can be very powerful for forging new neural possibilities for people.
And I perhaps just interject that Aiden has some interesting suggestions about the mechanisms of this and how they did it with attentional resources that I'd encourage people to follow up in his book.
Yeah, thanks. Yeah, because you get the same similar evidence for meditation practices, the connection between meditation and mental health.
And that's another feature of Aiden's book is that you see meditation as a psychedelic technique, and you continually treat it on a par with other forms of psychedelic experience. So.
Yeah, absolutely. And I would say, I'd say meditation is the ultimate. Yeah. But it takes a lot of hard work.
Yeah.
I used to meditate every morning until we had our second child, and then it's totally impossible. Occasionally, if I wake up early in the kids, I have a bit of meditation. But I have actually been trying to make sure I spend 20 minutes a day just being mindful. And I found that has been quite transformative, actually. Just usually when I'm walking around, just trying to, because I'm always lost in thought, you know, and just really paying attention to what I'm experiencing. And it can be really weird. It's like, you know, just really paying attention. Oh, this stuff is really quite weird. It's like visual experiences. And I did for the first time actually recently. What's it called? VR. And you know, oh my god, this is incredible. And but then taking it off, I was thinking, I mean, actually, real life is more incredible. It's like, look at visual experience. It's all this richness, but you just get so used to it. It's like, oh, it's boring. That's boring. Yeah. But I suppose, you know, just being mindful can bring you back to, wow, look at all this amazing stuff.
Yeah.
Philip, in my book, you're meditating. When you're doing that, that's meditation.
Aiden, do you think with meditation, so I think Keith's been coming back around to this as well. Like, do you think with meditation and psychedelics, do you think it is that psychedelics might make it more likely that the experience of meditation is then more powerful for you if you've once had a psychedelic experience? Or do you think it's that psychedelics help people clear that initial hurdle of like the hard work and give them that proof of concept so that they are more motivated to pursue meditation?
Yeah, it's a great question. I think the kind of annoying answer is that it really depends on the person and the type of meditation practice and the context. In my experience, and from talking to people, you know, who sort of do similar things, I find there's just all sorts of positive feedback loops.
Okay.
So meditating during a trip, meditating after a trip, and having those sort of the lingering effects of it, and then meditating like in the days afterwards to sort of notice how your mind is different each morning as you move further away from the trip. I mean it's wild, and then by studying the concepts, like maybe into Buddhist psychology, I actually really like yoga. So learning the concepts of yoga, I find really helpful. As you learn those concepts, and then you go back into the trips and meditate or do the yogic practices, more things open up. So it's just everything.
just reminded me of something that I once thought of doing something on that I never did, but really interesting. I was some years ago, I was talking to Russ Herbert about his method of descriptive experience sampling. If you get people to wear a little device on the belt and an earpiece, and the earpiece buzzes, bleeps at random points during the day. And when this happens, the idea is you write down what you're experiencing at that very moment, just the very quality of your immediate experience. And then there's a process of interpretation. Russ goes through the notes and helps people sort of improve their ability to report the unfiltered experiences, I suppose. I mean, I might have some worries about that. But the point of the technique is to try to explore the nature of experience. I mean, but one thing that Russ said was that he had a lot of feedback from people who've done this that it really was therapeutic, that they felt a lot better when they did this. And I could see that being easily interpreted through this idea of psychedelic experience, that what was being revealed to them was the nature of their immediate experience, that we too often gloss over. So it was making them momentarily mindful throughout the day. And it seems to me an unexplored angle on this, that's a very simple technique of inducing little moments of psychedelic experience, the way your own experience is revealed to you.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. I completely agree. I mean, that sort of technique is, you see that general strategy across a lot of different therapeutic paradigms. Mm-hmm. The paying attention to the present moment, being mindful of, mm-hmm. well, maybe so for example, all the internal signals that we mm-hmm. easily ignore, right? Mm-hmm. So if someone asks you a challenging question, you know, and it's a job interview or something like that. Mm-hmm. And you can, by paying attention to all the bodily signals that are coming up in that moment, if you just allow it and you're trying to force through it and you're paying attention to trying to figure out what your body is speaking, basically mm-hmm. telling you, you're going to get through that experience in a more effective way, right?
Of course, all of this can also be interpreted, I think, very easily through a Dinettian perspective, where what we're doing, where there's lots and lots of stuff going on, multiple drafts of experience, and probing yourself doesn't simply access one of those drafts. it gives it greater influence, but it's not exactly into conscience. That's a metaphor I'm a bit worried about, but it gives it greater influence. It makes it more influential. And so this process is also self-creative as well as self-exploratory. We are actively promoting certain strands in that and learning how to do that.
That's how I do that with these bands here. So, so these... This green and purple band, I can see it, I guess.
Yeah.
So this will take too long to explain in detail, that the current line of research that I'm doing has highlighted these things called chakras from yoga psychology as potentially being very useful for understanding the sort of the range of psychedelic experiences that people can have. And but these concepts are unusual, and a good way to learn them is to study them, like we would study anything, but then to experience them, to do that shift of phenomenal transparency that I mentioned earlier.
Yeah.
So you're experiencing and you're becoming familiar with them. And so as I'm doing that, one thing I do is I wear these bands, it's just a sort of fun way to remind me of a particular pairing or particular chakra as I go throughout the day. And I'm sort of, these things are kind of like different modes of consciousness, basically. They sound weirder than they actually are, I think. But paying attention, having these reminders to pay attention to these particular ones and how they combine as I go around today and do this podcast. That's an example of what you're talking about. It's like a way of designing the experience through an intervention.
I like that, designing experience. I like that.
Because it just pops out every now and then. I go, right. That's what I'm trying to do.
Yeah. All about salience.
Wow. It's been absolutely fascinating discussion. I think this has been a psychedelic experience, this whole discussion. My mind has been opened.
Revelatory. Yes. Yeah.
I need to go and, that was fun.
That's really good. Oh, thanks so much, guys. Thanks for taking the time, Sarah and Aidan, to share your insights with us on Mind Chat.
Thank you so much for having us.
It's been a pleasure. Thanks for having us. Yeah.
We must have you back again sometime and do more of this, because I think we could have gone on a lot longer, couldn't we?
Yeah, definitely.
Lots more to talk about.
I could talk forever about this.
I hope you will.
All right. Thanks a lot, guys. Hope to speak to you soon.
Likewise.
Take care. That was fascinating. That went in ways I didn't expect, actually. And yeah.
Same here. Well, that's what we say. It's revealing. That's what psychedelic experiences are. They're ones that reveal things you didn't expect.
Bringing in multiple drafts there. You might think I might disagree with you at this point, but I don't know if you know, Keith, Luke Roloffs has a paper combining panpsychism with Dennett's multiple drafts to form a kind of Dennettian panpsychism. So
I must have a look at that. Well, Luke, as you know, I think Luke is the most coherent and consistent panpsychist. He embraces universalism, as I've
more than
many
me.
Times.
Pardon? Oh my gosh! More than me.
You drifted away from the true faith. You were a universalist, and you drifted away from it. I've always told you that it's arbitrary to be anything other than a universalist. Either no composition or universal composition. They're the only coherent options. Anything else is. We've been through this. Luke,
right? Sorry, I am annoyed with you, though. I'm annoyed with you for a different reason. You've done it again, haven't you? You've got a funny name without telling me you were going to have a funny name. So then I turn up without a funny name, unless my name...
Well, it depends what people think of the funny name. If they think it's embarrassing and childish, then, you win. Aldous Huxley's book, The Doors of Perception, a name that's inspired the band, Jim Morrison, The Doors. I've never really opened the doors of perception, but maybe just the cat flap,
So for people listening on the audio, which there might not be any, because I don't think Keith's updated them for a while. Another bit of bitchy comment there. But Keith's name is Cat Flaps of Perception. Yeah, so every journey begins with a single footstep, Keith. I don't know why I said that. I thought it might sound profound.
I think the 3% credence to illusionism is your first step, Philip. And I think
what percentage would you give to panpsychism?
That's very interesting, and I'm not going to commit myself at this moment.
You're not playing the game.
I think there's an argument that I'm going to try and work this one out. I think I can leverage that 3%, given the right priors, into something quite significant. So I want to see how much I can do. I'll commit to something that you could do the same on.
Oh,
It's good. I was a bit of a rocky start because I know that was my fault, but I think we're back into it now, aren't we? I think we're back into the groove. So we've got
yes, some good ones. And we need to, with our supporters, we can do more. Hopefully, do more interesting things once I can find a second to get it together. Yeah. It's good fun. We are having some pretty unique conversations, I think.
Some fantastic guests, certainly. And I think we're trying to illustrate what we preach of. They say
showing why you're wrong. No, go. Sorry, I interrupted you.
Of that you learn philosophy by doing philosophy, and we're not here to try and teach people about philosophy. We're trying to sort of do a bit of philosophy live and try and get the people listening to engage with it and do a bit themselves. We're not in the business of teaching. We're in the business of stimulating philosophy, I hope. And showing that, as you said, that openness to other positions, friendly rivalry, but a willingness to engage is central to it.
Very constructive. Absolutely. Hear, hear. Well, I'm going to go and have a beer now, which can be perhaps a minor psychedelic. There's another great line from William James where he talks about how pitiful it is that some people's only access to spiritual reality is drunkenness, but we can have these spiritual experience on drunkenness, but it's pitiful that he says it much more profound than me. I should look that up. We'll put it in the notes.
William James is absolutely fantastic writer, philosopher, and psychologist. That's one thing we agree on. And there might be something else too, Philip.
You never know. Oh, yes. There is. Of course, there is one other thing we do agree on. I've forgotten about that. One thing you and I certainly agree on, and you and I, is that, you know, consciousness is wherever it is.
Nowhere else.
That was possibly the worst rendition of that ever, but never mind.